Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
I'm using a very familiar little story this morning. The monk, Zugan, used to start every day by saying out loud to himself, "Master, are you there?" And he would answer, "Yes, sir, I am." Then he would say, "Better sober up." And he would reply, "Yes, sir, I'll do that." And then he would say, "Look out now, don't let them fool you." And he would answer, "Oh, no, sir, I won't. You know, I use this little story in so many ways. And now, we're focused in pretty much to doing meditation. You know, there's a meditation group. And meditation is to become alert, very alert, to become aware. So that in a way, meditation is an every moment continuous effort. See, it's always a part of something in here that is in focus. See, something always is paying attention to what's going on in here and not necessarily out there. It's to be alert. See? So that you don't let your mind play tricks on you. Yeah, because after all, that's what fools us, isn't it? It's our own ideas. And, you know, we're very interested in this, and so we spend a little time in the morning, and, you know, we'll sit, and then we seem to leave it wherever we've been sitting. We put it aside, and we go out into this world in full consciousness. Do we go out into this world in full consciousness? You know, meditating, sitting for meditation for 1 hour in the morning, after you have ignored that part of yourself for 23 hours, to say nothing if you only sit 15 or 20 minutes, and then ignore, you've got no more time to spare. You've got no time. No time, huh? You're fooling yourself. Because the sitting for meditation is a matter of life and death. That's it. Now, consciousness is all the time. Can you think of a moment when consciousness is not? Oh, when you're asleep, consciousness is not. Well, what happens when you go to sleep? That's an important question. Do you think that the consciousness sort of evaporates or disappears and that a new consciousness builds itself up in the morning? If so, from whence cometh this new consciousness? What happened to the old consciousness? And how come this new consciousness can remember exactly what happened the preceding day? Or that you are so-and-so old, or so-and-so young? If consciousness departs when you sleep, then who or what is aware of any of your dreams? Where do you go when you go to sleep. You know, being conscious. You conscious, huh? Where do you go? Where do you come back from? Because certainly in the morning, there you are again. Now, this Zen man, Zugan, yeah, he knows all this. And yet, every morning, he calls to himself. You can do this, huh? This calling to yourself is an effort to be very alert, to be very conscious. It is a very helpful gesture. Okay? You can say, John, are you here? Lola, pay attention. You know? When you say your name sharply, huh? All of a sudden the thinking stops. And it brings you right into focus. And then this little Zen man would say, sober up. Be sincere. Be authentic. Don't play the games. You've spent most of your life playing games. Now sober up. We can fool around so much because, you know, basically, we're not aware of how much time we waste, how we waste the time, how we waste our energy, you know, how our very lives are wasted. On what? You know, because, you know, regardless of whatever our age is, very slowly, very gradually, it's going down the drain. Huh? Sober up! Be aware. It is a matter of life and death. If you are conscious, fully conscious, you will be conscious when you die. And you will die in consciousness. And it will be an entirely different world. You know, life here is not just to pass the time. It is to use, to reach deep within yourself, very deep into the center. And we've already wasted enough time. So be alert and see what is happening. See what you are doing. So what are you doing? Well, we're doing lots of things. We're searching for money, for one. We want that kind of security, and that's fine. We need it. All of us can use everything that we can get. But in the final analysis, when we're up against this end of our life, this very end, then what? Well, we can sort of, in a way, picture it, and we skip over it very quickly. We don't like to think about it. But at that time, the minute before you depart this world, money is useless. But in the meanwhile, we play the money game, and it's quite a game. You know, if you have more than I do, this is the way it usually goes. We don't maybe think this way, but this is the way it goes. If you have more than I do, I don't feel so good. I feel kind of inferior. I feel rejected. I feel left out. Life hasn't been fair. Poor me. Yeah? And then something happens. I meet somebody else, and I have more than they do. And now I feel good. I'm superior. I'm accepted. Life has been very good to me. I don't have to be that poor. No. This is the game we play. We swing back and forth through these polar opposites, rejected and accepted, rejected and accepted. And we do this much more than we realize, this game between these two. You know. Now, so you spend half your life doing this, trying not to feel rejected and trying to be accepted. What do you gain from this game? If you had all the money in the world at the moment that you die, you don't have a penny. You're in poverty. The whole wealth of the world will not make you rich in the true sense, that is, in the very richness of being, of understanding, the richness of wisdom. Money can't buy that. That has to come through your experiences. Playing games is not going to give you a depth of being. You know, over there, there's one person and he's after power. Somebody else is after prestige, a good reputation, you know. Somebody else is after sex. Somebody else is after somebody else or something else. Unless you touch yourself, unless you perceive the being, which is yourself, it's like it's all a game. And games exist on the surface. It's the waves of the ocean. And riding on these waves as if we were surfboarding, you know, we suffer. And once in a while, it's a nice day, and we have pleasure. And then we drift. We drift around and around and over all these waves. They just carry us, and we let them. See? And it is, you know, as if we were sitting on the outside of a garden wall. There's this lovely garden, you know, that is walled, and we are like a beggar. We want in. And this is the story of the young knight who went out into the world searching for this holy grail. And he searched and he searched, and coming back, he was old and spent and gray. And there is still is the garden wall that he left as a young man. And there is this beggar that is sitting by the garden wall. And this knight shares his last morsel of bread with this beggar. And the miracle happens. Yeah. We sit outside this garden wall. The wall, the garden that the Sufis call the enclosed garden of truth. You know. And we have been told to knock, you know, and the door shall be opened. But we don't have time. We're too busy playing games. One sits for meditation to remember. One sits to sober up. And this Zen man started every day like this. Called himself, be alert. Every morning, sober up. See, morning sets a pattern for the day. See, so the religious traditions usually ask for two prayers, one in the morning and one in the evening. In the morning, consciousness is rising out of its depths, and this meditation, this remembering, you know, it starts the pattern for the day. At night, when you go to sleep, you know, a little meditation, and it sets the pattern for the night, remembering who you are. And maybe, just maybe, something will occur during the sleep, and you will know it. And you will know it is not a dream. You know, the Mohammedans, they pray 5 times a day so that they have to keep this in mind all the time. So it's almost a continuous thing. They have to remember, well, now it's morning, pray. And now it's mid-morning, pray. Now it's noon, pray. Now it's afternoon, pray. Now it's evening, pray. You know, and the man calling from the minaret, you know, calling all the faithful to prayer. Allah, Ilya, Allah, you know. There is none but Allah. Yeah. And they unroll their prayer rugs, which they carry with them. And they face Mecca, which is their holy city. And they prostrate themselves. You know, this gesture of prostration You know, it symbolizes there is something greater than I, than me. It is a gesture of humility. And your humility shows when you bow, or it doesn't show when you bow. We gassho, we bow in humility, not to a person. You know, you bow to the place that you sit. Huh? You think you're bowing to what? Huh? Not to a person, certainly, but you're bowing to that great power. It is the power of the universe, and that is the one whom we all are. Yeah. And then we have this gesture in the bowing, you know. Teach me to let this power teach me. Yeah. It's a great thing. It'll open doors more than this will. Mm-hmm. Because then you are receptive. You acknowledge that this ego isn't really terribly important. Something else is. Yeah. And now, the philosopher René Descartes, he doubted. You know, he doubted everything. So he spent all his time in search of something which he would not doubt. There must be something in this world. I doubt, you know. But there must be something in this world that I don't doubt. And because for him, the one thing which cannot be doubted, that is the basis of our true existence. So I'm looking for that which cannot be doubted. You know, we have a lot of these, what ought to be believed. These can be doubted. This should be believed. These are not real foundations. This is the kind of foundation that's apt to sink. I believe because I should. I believe because I ought to. I believe because it's the easy way to do this. You know, it's like a house built on sand. And so this Mr. Descartes, he doubted. You know, the gods can be doubted. The world can be doubted. All this may only be a dream. It can be doubted. And then suddenly one day, he became aware that he couldn't doubt himself. You may say that you can be deceived about yourself. But someone or something has to be present to be deceived. Most people, of course, are deceived most of the time. But this philosopher, because mostly philosophy in the later days has become a thinking thing rather than the love of wisdom which it was originally. So he said, I think, therefore I am. And therefore I didn't have to doubt myself. Now that leaves a... Anyway, he tried. Buddha emphasized meditation, which is very different than believing. In meditation, you sit down and you're not supposed to believe anything. There is no need to move to something else in which you believe. In meditation, you close off the senses, you close the door to the world, and you are all alone. And when you find yourself in this place, all alone, then you can wake up. You know, there's a story, I think it's a Chinese story of the turtle. You know, and waters were rising, and he was in peril. And there along came the river, floating along, comes this piece of wood. So we got on the piece of wood, and he pulls in his feet and his tail and his head, and all there's left is a shell. And this shell, so-called shell, is just moving down the river. And all of a sudden there comes a twist in the current, and it turns the board with the turtle on it upside down for a split second. And there's a knothole in this board. And because the turtle is all pulled in, he has a single eye here. See? You know? And in that moment, he sees his son. And then it turns over again. But if he had not been all pulled in, he would not have seen anything. He would still be too busy out here. I like this and I don't like that. Questioning tigers. Now, and also we note that this little Zen man was not calling on God. He was not calling on Krishna. He was not calling on Allah. He is calling himself, you know, only himself, you know. Diane, are you here? Betty, are you here? William, are you here? And he also doesn't wait for God or the gods to answer. He calls himself and he answers himself. And who else is going to, you know? So each morning you call, and each morning you answer. But there's nobody else that's going to answer. Oh, are you here? Yes, sir, I'm here. And along with this verbalizing, see, you need to feel yourself being present. You need to feel the solidity that is in you. I am here. Feel it. Be here. Be now. Be alert. Pay attention. You know, when you call yourself, you know, your thinking stops. And there is the opportunity for alertness. See, the alertness, that alertness, thinking stops. In that attention, the thinking mind disappears. And when there is a no mind, there's a mushin, you know, there is meditation. The no thinking, mumin. Meditation is not something that is done by the mind. It is an absence of the thinking mind, not of the mind itself, of the thinking mind, the absence of the toys we play with, our thinkings and feelings, emotions. Now, Zen has in it this Chinese I'm not thinking very well this morning. What do I want to call it? Device. It's a device. It's upaya. We call it a mundo, which is the interview with the questions and the answers. You know, if it were very strict, Rinzai Zen, you would come in with your problem, the question you have been given. You would state it, you would answer it, and you would leave. We don't quite do that. We do the mundo thing. And the problem, or it is called in Zen, is the koan, is an inquiry of yourself. Now Zen, to know Zen, what it is, to come to knowing what Zen is, what Zen means. I mean, we can say it means meditation, but, you know, what Zen is, huh? This takes the questioning process. something like Descartes did, questioning, because, you know, to all this, everything that he doubted. But the Zen way is more of a Socratic method of finding out what existence is, which means finding out what you are, where you have come from, where you are going, what is this world, what are you doing in it, what is your purpose here, how come I'm here in the first place, why am I here, why is this world like it is, what was I before I was here, was I or was I not before I was here? See, questioning oneself. Nowhere is it used precisely as it is used in Zen. The questioning of oneself, to find oneself. Now, from the times of ancient Greece, where our culture began, to our modern-day science, it does seem that sooner or later, our ideas about ourself, about man, and about this universe flounder. There have been unexpected manifestations of human consciousness that shocks and horrifies the world. It is not only on a worldwide scale sometimes, but we do it to ourselves. And we have this eruption within ourselves, and then pretty soon we try to pull it back together, and in so doing we have a new kind of a philosophy, maybe, or a new kind of psychology that rises. And we again grasp ourselves in what we think is a more responsible manner, only to find out that sooner or later, this whole edifice again crumbles in the face of a new atrocity or a new war, be it out there or be it in myself. We deceive ourselves. We fool ourselves. This is a fact of human life. And it does show us, or it should show us, that we need a completely new, a completely different understanding of inquiry. Philosophy is a way of life. You know, as it was, as the love of wisdom. It is not the study at this moment of the different ways that life has been perceived in the past, because there is a whole history of philosophy which brings us to this so-called pinnacle today. We have our own philosophy, each of us. You know, I stand up here and spout mine. Our philosophy that walks hand in hand with our religious attitude. And it has been said by some, and it has been realized by some, that ideas by themselves do not raise the level of human life. Not even a great idea. So this is philosophy of today. Not even the ideas of Christ or of Moses or of Krishna, Patanjali, Ramanuja, Nagarjuna, you know. Through these ideas that they have left behind, we may wish we could understand. We may hope for better days. But ideas alone, without some action on our part, does not transform human life. And there have been men of great goodwill who have fashioned, you know, magnificent teachings that had no real transforming power at all. They're mental stopgaps. They're mental musings. They're emotional playthings, but not real transforming power in them. A good idea will make us feel good. A bad thought may make us feel bad. But the thought, in this instance, good or bad, has only aroused our emotions. It has not transformed. It has not really changed us. It has changed the content of the consciousness. You know, move something over here and move something over here. You know, we've been, again, riding a wave, and that ocean remains very deep and undisturbed. Every day, almost, and in almost every life, things happen, manifestations appear within us for which we seem to have no responsibility. We don't have responsibility. And we do say to ourselves and we say to others, how can this happen to me? Because I don't think this way. This is not me. And yet it's going on. Huh? From whence does all this that is not me, but is going on in me, from whence cometh it? These odd things, these ill-assorted manifestations, they rise, and they have no relationship whatsoever to these lovely ideals that I hold in my mind, in my objective consciousness. Do I pay attention? Am I sobering up? This just isn't me. It's not me. It's not me. In reading of the past, of the long days gone by, they used a word, and that word was virtue. There have been books written about virtue. And the word virtue today, or several years ago, at any rate, upon coming across a book, The Virtue of Religion or The Virtue of Human Nature. Well, who wants that? Out of fashion. Socrates, through his student Plato, thought that neither science nor religion, not the religion of his day, know the science of his day, which is not very different than ours, not very different at all. Neither would lead a man to virtue. We think of virtue as being a conformity to a right, you know, a particular right. So, you know, a beneficial quality it is, or a manly strength, or a kind of a courage, or chastity as a virtue. See? These things we think of virtues. No wonder it's gone out of style. Yeah. Now, as I understand it, as I have read, and as I have been told, and as I have gone through my thing, virtue a long time ago, in Socrates' time, in old ancient Greece, virtue was associated with the mind, that is, the objective conscious mind, in its relationship to the unconscious human structure. The relationship between the two. What we know as things, as a world of appearance, and what we do not know. See, the path between. See? and to him the aim, and the only aim of a human being was to create this path, this relationship between ideas and what we thought the truth was, and the mind, you know, on the one hand, and the unconscious structure of human nature on the other hand. See, our instinctive human organism. And then the synthesizing, the merging of the conscious organization and the unconscious organism. This form of unity. This is Socrates. Our consciousness, our objective self-consciousness, we are conscious of ourselves as object. We are conscious of everything else as object. So we, of course, are conscious of ourselves as object. Objective self-consciousness, the ego. Ego function. Okay? It rises from the unconscious. A little more and a little more and a little more. And it has nothing, this has nothing to do with manliness or chastity or conforming to others' opinions or what we should believe or what we shouldn't believe. It has to do with confronting ourselves, which does take courage, and in this confrontation to ask what or who we may be. Who is this that aspires to know in the Gnostic sense? You know, this quality of mind that knows the spirit, that knows the soul. So we could imagine ourselves living in Athens in those days. Very similar days to our own. And in our life, maybe, perchance, we had the good fortune to meet with a strange man. We call him strange because he had strange and unusual questions. And he would walk the streets of Athens, and he would question people. Or maybe you might meet him at a gathering, or at a party, or he was at the Senate, and he questioned. He wandered the streets of Athens, questioning, upsetting people's opinions about themselves and about the world in which they lived. One of the most influential minds ever, ever, to be the most influential mind of one's neighborhood? Pretty good. You know, to influence women in the neighborhood, to keep their houses cleaner, to bring up their children better, to be the most influential mind in a neighborhood, to be the most influential mind in a graduating class so that you can be valedictorian and such, to be the most influential mind at the workplace, or in one's field of endeavor, is never anything to be scorned. No. But to be one of the most influential minds in Western history? Yeah. Now, Socrates' questioning, his inquiry, was fixed on one thing: the absence of virtue. And he considered this virtue, the relationship of the objective conscious mind and the unconscious mind, he considered that to be the only factor of importance in human life. The search for oneself. He was not a religious teacher. Amazing, huh? He was not. He was not a scientific thinker. Huh? Isn't that interesting? He didn't fit any recognizable category. So what was he? He questioned. He interrogated. He was always pressing after this overlooked factor in our lives, this virtue. There he exerted his strength, and he continues to exert a great influence through the world, through our Western world anyway. What was Socratic questioning? Why was his aim, virtue pursued, through questioning rather than through some analysis of concepts, to lay out a whole string of concepts? There's the way it should be. He didn't. He questioned what we already had. He questioned our usual way, which our usual way is sort of a synthesis of ideas, we have some legislation and we have some symbols, all the methods that we use to transmit ideas. He didn't. He just questioned. And to question about him is to question about existence. It is to question ourselves. This faculty of inquiry, this ability of inquiring, which we have, and how often do we use? Rarely. I mean rarely. Seldom, if ever. Put it that way. This kind of inquiry, this faculty, is not known under the names such as metaphysical speculation or some kind of introspection or scientific analysis, nor is it spiritual doctrine, nor moral reasoning, nor is it criticism. It is not the establishment of a system of ideas, nor is it an organization of a particular school of thought, nor is it the founding of a religion, nor is it the founding of a state. The Socratic questions, they are attempts again and again and again to penetrate through, to go behind, to transcend the world of appearance, the world of emotional appearances, as well as the perceptual, sensual appearances. The world that I see, and the world that I like, and the world that I don't like, the world to which I am so attached, the world to which I cling. See? The questioning of all of that. Zen calls it doubt. We can doubt. It is allowable. Should be. Somebody says something, doubt it. Doubt me, of course, but with the right questions. Not some bamboozling of your own mind. Socrates is an unknown. He's very great. And this should be kept in mind. And it should be mulled over, his virtue seeking and his questioning. And it should be mulled over again and again and again until we begin to feel what really is at issue. The issue. The very serious questions which every human being must ask. Who am I? Where did I come from? And where am I going? At issue also is the fact that when I respond to a great idea, there's something in me that leaps to this thing, like a fish to bait. I respond to great ideas, that I respond with a part of myself of which I am not usually aware. It's a part of me that seems to lie hidden until this something comes along and I leap to it. Something in me leaps to it. And at the same time, in this response, you see, I see the chaos and the struggle of my life, my own life, and I see it at the same time, the struggle of all men and women. I see the merry-go-round of illusions. I see the meaninglessness of it. It's just going round. See? And it all ends in death. I may love the greatness of truth, and I may respond. But all by itself, this does not change me. And it is this very change, this transformation that we are interested in and that we are speaking about. What action in myself is necessary so that this energy of the truth itself transforms my flesh and blood? Socratic questioning, huh? And it is this kind of interrogation, which is Zen's method. It is a way, it is a method of education, a way that draws out of you, out of me, out of anyone, the truth. It does not put something in, it draws it out, because we know. We have known from the beginning, and we're just too busy playing games to settle down and let ourselves know what we know. Huh? The Zen method, the Socratic method, the confrontation of ourselves with inquiry. Are you there? Oh, yeah, I'm here. Oh, I hope I'm here anyway. Am I really here? The questioning with intentness, through which a process of transformation begins to take place. The question put, the intentness of attention in meditation. The senses all drawn in, all alone with this question. If we are at all serious about ourselves, we must question. We question the world. The questioning begins here, right here, myself. I am alone. Let's face that first of all. I am alone. Yeah. All else exists, as it were, seemingly outside of me. And, you know, we're speaking pretty much of an ordinary, everyday way of looking at things. Everything is out there. Yeah. We don't usually say, well, I have projected my view of the world out there. We don't usually do that. But with all of these appearances, this world of appearances in which I live, there it's in here, huh? There is something else in me that is my own. It's not from the world. I am alone. Something is all my own. There is something in me that is free, that is autonomous, that is self-ruling. But what is it? What is it? See, now the question has a kind of a force in it. It has a power. It is no longer a game of concepts. It is a questioning as an act of attention. See? Calling to oneself, pay attention, sober up. This confrontation leads to a very special inner struggle. It is not a struggle if this is right and this is wrong and which should I choose. It has nothing to do with that. Yep. But there is an inner struggle. spiritual struggle. And this is what Socrates taught, and this is what he exemplifies. This is the struggle of self-interrogation. It is not introspection. It is not insight. It is not an emotional realization. It is not a self-manipulation. It is not the formation of theories about oneself. It is not self-moralizing. It is not science. It is not psychology as we understand it today, nor is it political action. All by ourselves. This confrontation with oneself brings about this yearning, this longing of being, to be, instead of always becoming something, to be, to have the solidity of myself right here. What one is now and what one is meant to be. My destiny, huh? And this is the fire through which we must pass to come into our own. Our own birthright, our own destiny. Yeah. You know, the student of Socrates, who was Plato, allows himself, as he writes about his teacher, he allows his teacher to present himself as a man who does not know. He's got all these cotton-picking questions, you know? And it's as if Plato depicts him as if the wisdom that he has consists in the fact that he alone, of all the people in Athens, realizes his own ignorance. Now, everyone sees through this, including you and me, after all these 2,500 years later when we read. And this is exactly how Zen handles it. The ignorance. You know, Bodhidharma, when he came to China to bring the teaching, you know, the emperor built many temples, spread his teaching all around, and came to him and said, because I have done all these good works, what do I get as merit? What is the reward? And Bodhidharma said, no merit, nothing holy. And then, so this man, this emperor says, well then, you're spreading the teaching here in China. Why did you come to China? And Bodhidharma says, you know, the cypress tree grows in the garden. And this emperor looks at him, you know, these funny answers. And says, who are you? Who are you? You know. And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. One of the greatest masters, huh? The man who recognizes his own ignorance. Now, Bodhidharma knew darn well enough, you know. But the ability to say, I don't know. Yeah. That's Bodhidharma's Zen. Yeah. A man who recognizes his own ignorance. And ignorance in this instance does not mean stupid. But you confront your own ignorance. Confront your own unknowing, which also does not mean the ability or the inability to answer a question. It doesn't mean that at all. Yeah. Confront your own unknowing. You know, like the monk back there in the 14th century, he wrote this book, The Cloud of Unknowing. Yeah. With Socrates, there comes, as it were, a great silence. What is this teaching? Because he didn't write books about this is the way it should be, and this is how I perceive it, and this whole system of ideas, and blah, 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 you know. What is the teaching behind the Socratic silence? behind his power of self-interrogation. What is it? He must have had his ideas about man and his man's place in the universe. That surely was behind all his questioning. He didn't just question down to be, you know, who would bother to write about him then, you know. He must have had these ideas that were far, far beyond theories, accumulated knowledge, concepts, and explanations. Socratic silence is more than our accumulated knowledge. There must have been behind this silence, you know, his ignorance, his silence, huh? A knowing which we all seek. What is that knowing? What is that knowing? What is that faculty in us? To give it a name? Oh, that's very easy. We can call it by any name. But what is it? What is it? What is that knowing that stands behind the Socratic method of life? And of course, you know, even more fascinating than the question of who could have been Socrates' teacher. Behind Plato stands the immensity of Socrates. What greatness, what immensity stands behind Socrates? So we can begin to look, and we can begin to question, for that immensity that stood behind Socrates, that stood behind Plato, stands behind each and every one of us now. Each and every one. So turn around. I don't mean your body. Turn around the mind. Never mind the desires. The consciousness. Find the consciousness and turn it around. Turn around and question. Turn around and ask. And don't let the answers fool you. Do not be deceived. Okay? And now, may the peace, the power that is beyond all understanding, hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.